Hello and welcome back to UG Journal Podcast. I'm Mohsin Subhani, trainee editor at UG Journal and Advanced Endoscopy Fellow at Nottingham University Hospitals.
And I'm Manuela, trainee editor of the UG Journal and the gastroenterologist based in Porto, Portugal.
Today we are exploring an increasingly relevant topic in IBD care, the use of sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor modulators in ulcerative colitis. We'll be covering how this drug class works, what to look out for in terms of safety and drug interaction, and whether these therapies can be used alongside commonly prescribed medication, such as opioids and antidepressants.
Yes, and to help us unpack this, we are delighted to be joined by Professor Anita Afzali. Anita Afzali is the James Hedy Endowed Chair and Professor of Medicine at University of Cincinnati, where she also serves as Executive Vice Chair of Internal Medicine and Associate Chief Medical Officer of UC Health. A board-certified gastroenterologist specializing in IBD, Professor Afzali is a national leader in healthcare operations, clinical outcomes research, and public health advocacy. She has authored nearly 100 publications and holds leadership roles in the American College of Gastroenterology and the World Gastroenterology Organization. Professor Afzali, welcome and thank you for being here.
Thank you both. It's really a pleasure to join you and talk about a topic that's increasingly relevant in day-to-day clinical practice.
Thank you. Excellent to have you here. So let's start. So based on your expertise in IBD, Professor Afzali, our listener would be quite interested to know that specifically in this context, when we're using medication like opioids and antidepressant, which are frequently prescribed in this context, how prevalent this chronic pain and depressions and mental health issues are in IBD settings?
Yes, absolutely. So pain, fatigue, mood disorders such as depression and anxiety are very common in inflammatory bowel disease, and it impacts both quality of life as well as disease outcomes. So studies have actually shown that about 20% of patients with inflammatory bowel disease use opioids, and approximately 18% are on antidepressants, with the use of these medications being even higher after or following the diagnosis. So this truly highlights the importance of addressing mental health as well as pain management as an integrated part of inflammatory bowel disease care.
Combining these medications with UC therapies can raise concerns, particularly around potential drug-drug interactions, especially when it comes to serotonin toxicity. Professor Afzali, for those less familiar, could you give us a brief overview of how S1P modulators work and where they might fit into UC treatment pathways?
Yes, so S1 modulators like etrasimod are oral small molecules that selectively block sphingosine 1-phosphate receptors, preventing lymphocyte egress from lymph nodes. So this reduces gut inflammation and ulcerative colitis, and they're positioned as advanced therapies for moderate to severe UC, particularly in patients who are seeking effective oral therapeutic options.
Excellent. That's all very interesting. Shall we turn our attention to your recently published article in UG Journal? And I believe this was a postdoc analysis from your recent two RCTs. So would you mind telling us what you looked at specifically when you were looking at the data?
Yeah, so we conducted a post hoc safety analysis looking specifically from the data of Elevate UC52 and the UC12 trials. And we specifically evaluated the risk of serotonin toxicity when etrasimod is used with opioids or antidepressants. Now, this is important because another S1P modulator, ozanimod, has structural properties that inhibit monoamine oxidase, which can increase serotonin toxicity risk when it's combined with the medications we talked about, the opioids or antidepressants. Since etrasimod does not have the molecular structure as ozanimod does, we wanted to confirm its safety profile in this context.
Wonderful. And what were the main findings from the analysis?
Well, we found that the incidence of adverse events potentially related to serotonin toxicity was actually quite low and even comparable between those taking etrasimod with or without opioids or antidepressants. And importantly, there were no serious adverse events or serotonin toxicity that was reported.
I must say this is all very reassuring, especially when there is an increasing trend of polypharmacy in IBD. So if we hit the nail, what is your overall clinical takeaway from this data and what you would recommend a clinician who are practicing in IBD or as a frontline worker who is seeing this patient in any rooms or in clinics?
Certainly. I think that these results suggest that etrasimod can be safely used alongside both opioids and antidepressants. And we should have a sense of comfort knowing that there's minimal, if any, concerns regarding the drug-drug interactions and specifically the risk for serotonin toxicity. And particularly because naturally we know that our patients with inflammatory bowel disease have other comorbid conditions, and also recognizing that impact of mental health and pain management. So the risk of polypharmacy is there, but I hope that this post hoc analysis is able to provide that reassurance on the potential risk or no risk of drug-drug interactions.
Wonderful. And looking ahead, are there any plans to expand on these findings in the real-world setting or through longer-term follow-ups?
Definitely. We plan to have long-term follow-up that's actually ongoing with Elevate UC, the open label extension, as well as ongoing assessments in actual real-world clinical practice. And these analyses, I think, will further help us better validate the findings that we were able to provide from the post hoc analysis into a broader clinical setting.
It's all very encouraging to have more oral options in treatment for UC. So before we move on to next, in context of S1P modulator like estrocimodes we're talking about, are there any practical tips that you would offer to the listeners before considering these medications?
Sure, absolutely. I think it's important just before we consider any start of medications, I think it's important to be able to focus on both a thorough review of other medical comorbidities, medication lists, making sure your patients are up to date with their vaccinations and immunizations. And then specifically with our S1Ps and etrasimod as an example, it'll be important to have a baseline cardiovascular and eye ophthalmologic evaluation. But otherwise, again, what I really want to emphasize is that all of our therapies requires the basic level of routine labs and monitoring, preventative screening, and immunizations that should be highlighted for all patients with inflammatory bowel disease.
Amazing. So to summarize, symptoms like pain and depression are common in patients with ulcerative colitis, and this analysis suggests that etrasimod can be used safely alongside opioids and antidepressants, which may reassure both clinicians and patients navigating combination therapies.
Yes, that's correct. And thank you again, both, for allowing me to be a part of this important discussion and for inviting me today. I think as clinicians, we must remember that IBD management goes far beyond controlling intestinal inflammation. We need to focus on pain, fatigue, anxiety, depression. These are so commonly rooted and impacts our patients' day-to-day functions, right? And so I hope that this study reassures the use of etrasimod as an oral S1P modulator, and in the meantime, being able to control the mental health and pain management component, whether it's with antidepressants, anti-anxiolytics, opioid management, etc. But overall, I hope that this was able to emphasize the importance of mental health and symptom management as we're establishing our IBD care pathway for each individual patient, and hopefully helping each of our patients live a fuller and healthier life ahead.
Professor Afzali, thank you very much for joining us and for sharing your expertise. Now, for our listeners, if you like to read more on the topic, please click on the link for this article and also read other relevant articles like S1P receptor modulator for treatment of UC, a narrative review, and also a gastroenterologist guide to drug interactions of small molecules in IBD. Well, so that was excellent to have Professor Afzali, and it was very educational. So let's divert our attention and take our listeners to another field of gastroenterology. So we'll be talking about something very important and very close to my heart. There's something called hepatic encephalopathy in liver disease. So we'll be discussing an article recently published by Marie Curdler and colleagues from Paris. This was a retrospective analysis looking into 179 ICU patients with cirrhosis with overt encephalopathy and for whom West Haven grade equal to or more than 2 and plasma ammonia was actually consistent with the diagnosis of hepatic encephalopathy. And they look into what are the typical factors or multiple factors that can trigger the HE.
And the results were quite revealing. Every patient in the cohort had at least one identifiable precipitating factor, whether it was infection, acute kidney injury, gastrointestinal bleeding, hyponatremia, or recent exposure to sedative medications.
But even more concerning, 82% of the patients presented with multiple concomitant precipitating factor, they were not incidental and they had direct negative impact on clinical outcomes.
Exactly. And the in-hospital mortality rate was 50% and median transplant-free survival was just 0.8 months. That's less than a month from IQ admission to either death or transplant.
And interestingly, when authors conducted multivariate analysis, the number of precipitating factor were directly related to either overall mortality or liver transplant. And most important to highlight the stage of liver disease as calculated by MELD score, Child-Pugh score, ACLF grade, coexisting infection, and AKI.
And importantly, for patients who survived the index hospitalization without undergoing liver transplantation, the story didn't end here. Recurrent hepatic encephalopathy developed in 42% of them, particularly in those with metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, MASLD, or a high MELD score at baseline. 41% had medication which precipitate hepatic encephalopathy, such as benzos.
So Manuela, looking at this study, for our listeners, what this means for our clinical practice?
So I think there are three evidence-based takeaways. First, systematic identification of all precipitating factors is critical. Detecting one should prompt through investigation of additional co-triggers. Second, early comprehensive management of a reversal precipitating factors is essential. This includes antimicrobial therapy, hemodynamic support, electrolytes correction, and of course, careful prescription of neurotoxic agents. And also then the third, multiplicity of precipitating factors must be considered a prognostic variable in its own right. It has implications not only for acute management, but of course also for timely referral to transplant evaluation.
So in short, I think it would be fair to say that hepatic encephalopathy is a manifestation of multiple factors in chronic liver disease, not simply correlated to having high ammonia. And early identification of correctable causes directly correlate to the outcome of the patient. Great. So now let's move on to endoscopy. And I believe this would be of interest to our listeners. We will be talking about delayed post-palpectomy bleeding and in specific cohort of the patient with chronic kidney disease. So we will take you down to this study that connects people who have delayed bleed and how that is associated with chronic kidney disease.
So delayed post-palpectomy bleeding is not the most common complication. It occurs in up to 1% in average risk patients undergoing palpectomy. However, when this happens, it can lead to extra procedures, hospital stays, and definitely patient discomfort.
Exactly. So we will be discussing this large-scale study done by Hyun and et al. From Korea. They included over 21,000 patients who underwent colonoscopy with polyp removal. And what makes this study stand out is size and detailed analysis that they have applied.
Yes, indeed, they used two robust methods. One was propensity score matching and the other inverse probability weighting. That means that they carefully adjusted for factors like age, medications, polyp size, and other health conditions to really isolate the effects of chronic disease on bleeding risk.
And the results were quite clear. Patients with CKD had roughly 2 times higher risk of delayed bleeding compared to those without CKD. What is particularly striking is that even early stage CKD showed similar increase in the risk.
Yes, that caught my attention too. Early stage CKD is often underestimated when it comes to procedural risks. But here, patients in stage 1 and 2 had more than double the bleeding risk, and it climbed even higher for advanced CKD stages.
Now, this makes me wonder that what is so specific about CKD that increased the risk of bleeding? So actually, authors pointed out several possible explanations to this, and one of that is related to endothelial and platelet dysfunction, and probably that's correlated to increased risk of bleeding in this cohort.
And in advanced CKD, the situation worsens. You get platelet dysfunction and accumulation of toxins, what of course can also contribute to easier bleeding.
So the study also highlighted a clinical dilemma. So on one hand, there is increased risk of bleeding in CKD after polypectomy, but these patients are also at increased risk of colorectal cancer. So they do require colonoscopy and polypectomy as indicated, but we need to appreciate this increased risk and make arrangements to manage this proactively.
Yes, Mosen, and that's why the author suggests special precautions, careful inspection of the polyp site, considering cold snare techniques instead of heat-based ones, and possibly using clips in higher risk cases, even though this is not, of course, the standard for everyone.
And to end, what the author mentioned, that while delayed polypectomy bleed is really life-threatening, it does impact healthcare costs, patient quality of life, hospital resources, and their experience of having procedure. So despite all this limitation, one limitation this study mentioned is that it's mainly done in Korea. So we need to take into consideration when we're generalizing the results to Caucasian population. Yet the information conveyed is very important, and we should be mindful when scoping this group of patients.
So, and finally, we will dive into the first in-human study exploring new approaches to treating type 2 diabetes mellitus using something called duodenal mucosal laser ablation. It's a mouthful, but it could represent a step forward in how we manage diabetes beyond medications or surgery.
Exactly. So to set the stage, type 2 diabetes affects millions globally, even with advances like GLP-1 receptor antagonist or other effective medication in market, many patients don't reach optimal glycemic control. So there is a room to look for alternative treatment options.
Yes, of course. And while bariatric surgery is effective, it's invasive, costly, and of course, frankly, underutilized. Indeed, less than 2% of eligible patients actually undergo it.
So Manuela, what is the idea behind new technique? The study used DIGMA system, an endoscopic device that applies laser ablation to submucosal layer of duodenum.
So we know that the duodenum's role in glucose regulation has gained attention recently. By modifying its lining, this study aims to influence nutrient sensing and metabolic signaling without cutting or rerouting anything.
In this first in-human trial, 31 patients with type 2 diabetes were enrolled between 2017 and 2020. 25 received therapeutic laser doses.
Yes, and what about the results? At 6 months, there was an average reduction in hemoglobin A1C of 0.6%. At 12 months, the reduction was 0.4%. And even though this may sound modest, we need to remember that these patients were not changing medications, diet, or lifestyle during study period.
That is the key. Plus, fasting glucose dropped by around 28 milligrams per deciliter at 12 months. There were also improvements in postprandial glucose and in insulin resistance as measured by HUMA-IR.
So now, Mosen, I know what's everyone wondering. Was this procedure safe?
It's very important and good question. Study report no device or procedure-related severe adverse events. Statistically, with 25 patients treated, the upper confidence limit suggests that true event rate could be up to 11.3%, but nothing was observed here. Follow-up endoscopy showed no concerning changes either. It is reassuring, and the natural, much larger trials are needed before bringing this into clinical practice.
So, right. And while this study was a single-arm, open-label study, there was no control group. This is certainly a promising sign of.
One point that I found interesting, unlike bariatric surgery, this procedure doesn't seem to induce significant weight loss. It's about glycemic control specifically. This raises the idea of targeting metabolic pathway directly without necessarily affecting the weight, almost like editing the metabolic software without changing the hardware.
Wow, Mohsen, that is quite a poetic analogy.
Seriously, though, this is the step toward minimal invasive metabolic therapies that bridges the gap between medication and surgery.
So, of course, it's early days. The DIGMA system isn't FDA approved yet. And as the authors clearly note, a sham controlled trial will be essential to confirm these results and is mandatory before any further regulatory approvals.
Thank you very much for listeners for staying with us. I hope you have enjoyed this special episode and our special guest. So don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And until the next episode, please keep questioning evidence.